Welcome to the Social Justice Salon. I am your hostess, Marianne Moore, a social justice advisor and political philosopher passionate about recreating our world. In this podcast, we will evoke the grand revolutionary salons of the past by engaging with thinkers and practitioners about social justice issues, showcasing grassroots activism, diving into theory and grounding ourselves with everyday methods to effect real-life change in society. Join us and we will furnish you with the knowledge and clarity you need to understand and improve our world. Let's enter the salon. Hello and welcome back to the Social Justice Salon. This episode is episode 21. I've been getting some really lovely feedback from people about episode 20 and some of the other episodes, so I'm glad that you're enjoying them. This episode, we are tackling quite a difficult subject. It is a criminal justice themed episode, and we are actually talking about very high-risk sexual abuse with a very, very interesting and amazing woman called Rhianna Taylor. But this topic may be a bit difficult for some people and it may be triggering. So I wanted to say that now. We don't talk about anything particularly graphic, but the notion of discussing serious sexual abuse and perpetrators of that abuse may well be tricky for some people. So please be aware of that and the topic. So the person joining me, as I said, is Rhianna Taylor. She's the CEO of Circles UK, who are a really innovative and interesting community-based organisation. Circles of Support and Accountability. They are basically a community initiative that is designed to reduce sexual offending among perpetrators. So among high-risk perpetrators who have come out of prison and are now in the community. So Rhianna Taylor, before joining Circles in 2016, was the director of operations for two different community rehabilitation companies and also the deputy chief and director of strategy for the Thames Valley Probation in 2002. She's worked as a consultant in China and Vietnam for the UNDP and the Rego Foundation and was formerly part of Nelson Mandela's first democratic government in South Africa as Chief Director of the Department of Safety and Security. So she's got some really, really fascinating experience, and the work that Circles UK do is incredibly important when we think about actually trying to stop very, very difficult and harmful sexual abuse by serious perpetrators. I do hope you find this episode interesting and that it opens your mind to what can be achieved in the community with even very serious offenders when you take this approach of both support and accountability that Circles UK have. So without further ado, let's go and join Rhianna and hear what she has to say about the very important work that she and Circles UK do. Hi, Rhianna. It's lovely to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, Marianne. Thank you so much for having me. It's I always so appreciate it when people are interested in our work.
Definitely. Your work is fascinating. And I think we're going to have a really, really interesting discussion today. Where are you based? Where are you calling in from today?
I'm at home today, working from home, and my home is the lovely Bath. So I'm very privileged and lucky to be living in such a lovely little city.
Yes, of course. And I remember because I was born in Bath, so I have a lot of affection for Bath. Amazing. Well, we're going to talk today about your organisation, Circles UK, and a bit about yourself and your work. It would be great if you could, just to start us off, just give us a bit of an introduction to yourself in your own words.
Thank you. Yes, I have lived in a number of contexts, and I always think that one is so enormously shaped by where you come from and the context within which you've grown up and your first impressions and so on. And for me, I think what shaped me enormously was growing up in apartheid South Africa, you know, and living under a highly repressive regime where some people had all the privileges and other people had none. Mm. And then seeing the transformation process in South Africa, going over to Nelson Mandela's release from prison, and then helping design a new reality for South Africa. I think that has really, really shaped who I am, my thinking, my values, etc. I am deeply aware of social justice issues, about issues of fairness, the importance of democratic values, and people who are abused by others in so many different ways. And I think my tiny little attempt in life has been to shine a light on people who are being abused, and in many different forms, whether it's politically, sexual, physical, etc. And I think that is reflected in all the roles I've held in my career. I don't believe we can change the world, but I do think we can change a small corner of it. And that has really been the driving force for me. And working now very much in the area of sexual abuse, both against adults and children, tapped into all my previous experience and my previous context. And I think that is what gives me purpose, advocating day after day, you know, for the importance of this work and creating societies that's free from abuse.
Amazing. Yeah, that I can imagine that growing up in apartheid South Africa and actually being able to help shape a country that was, you know, trying to create equality in that sense must have been really, really formative. So yeah, thank you so much. And we are going to be getting quite deep into, yeah, difficult subjects today, I think. And the work that you do is not, you know, kind of an easy piece of work. It would be great if you could just describe a little bit about your organization, Circles UK, and what its aims are.
Yes, so Circles UK is the national organization that oversees the provision of a specific program for perpetrators of sexual abuse, and we call that Circles of Support and Accountability. Now, it's a bit of a mouthful, but I can later in our discussion always explain why we call it that, you know, because that is very deliberate. And Circles UK was set up originally to oversee the provision of circles of support and accountability. And we work with approved providers who, you know, we help when they become circle providers. We kind of coach them, mentor them, give them the core materials that they need to provide circles. And then we support them throughout. They have to be members of Circles UK because Circles UK owns the intellectual property rights of Circles. And, you know, so you can't deliver Circles without being affiliated to Circles UK. That is really important. And we are very fortunate that we have some amazing organizations out there who deliver Circles every day for us. And we obviously work very, very closely with them. Circles UK's role is to develop new programs. We do that in consultation with our providers, obviously, and with their input and their expertise. And we also create a code of practice for them, which they have to adhere to. And every 2 years, we have compulsory audits of all our providers to ensure that their service is safely delivered to the highest professional standards. And this is largely because the majority of circles are for people that are very high risk of sexual reoffending and sexual harm causing. So it is really, and because our program is delivered by volunteers who are also amazing people, we will talk about them today as well. It is really important that there's an arm's length body to regulate it all, looking at it all, making sure that it is delivered as safely as it can and that we protect communities and prevent further victims. We are absolutely passionate about our vision, which is to prevent further victims. And we work with perpetrators in order to achieve that vision.
I think it probably would be good to start to talk, yeah, immediately about what you mean when you say circles of support and accountability, because it is so key, isn't it, to how you're operating. Are you able to just break that down for us?
Yes, absolutely. And that's, you know, what I think, and I would say that because it's our programs, isn't it? But I think the way circles are designed is incredibly clever. And every component that forms a part of it has been carefully designed and thought through. And there's a reason why we have that. So the name Circles of Support and Accountability is far more than a support program. We also support people, obviously, but there's very much the accountability aspect. And what that means is we tend to work with people who are on the very serious end of sexual abuse. So typically, the people who we work with in circles, who we call core members, the core member of a circle, they have been in prison for quite a lengthy period. And when they come out of prison, they are normally released under multi-agency public protection arrangements. Now, members of the public aren't always aware of these arrangements. People don't just come, you know, with that level of serious offending. They don't just come out of prison and they are completely free, because part of their sentence, they actually still serve in the community. So they come out under supervision to the probation service, and they also subject to police registration and notification requirements and what we call multi-agency public protection arrangements. And what a circle does, when a referral comes to us and we set up a circle, we do that in partnership with those statutory agencies, probation, police, it can be health, it can be whatever agency is needed to oversee the progress of the core member, to make sure that they don't reoffend and our communities are safe. And that is the accountability aspect. So our volunteers who run the circles under the oversight of a paid coordinator, if they pick up anything that causes concern or that can indicate an escalating risk situation where a person maybe could go and harm a child or a vulnerable adult, they will alert their coordinator, who then makes contact with the statutory agencies and say, look, we have a problem here. And just so that you know, this is done with full knowledge of the core member. And that is the accountability aspect. We are absolutely transparent about it and make sure that we prevent further offending. And then the other aspect of a circle is the support. You know, if people work with us in their accountability arrangements in partnership with the statutory agencies, we give them full support to help rebuild their lives after a long prison sentence. They often are shunned by their communities when they return. People don't want contact with them. Their families don't want to see them, etc. And the support aspect is where we work with them on a very individual basis and say, what are the issues for you? How can we help you? It could be something like accommodation. It could be employment. It could be training. It could be relationship difficulties. It could be literally anything that that person is having in their lives. So the two aspects, accountability and support, go hand in hand. You can't have a circle with only one. It has to be both.
Yes, I can see that. It makes a lot of sense, because it's important to set boundaries and obviously be clear about what's acceptable and not acceptable. But at the same time, nobody can kind of rebuild their life or change their life without some level of support as well. And that's what you're aiming to do.
Right. And what is quite interesting is sometimes it's the core members themselves who come to the circle and say, I have to share some information with you. I can feel my risk is increasing. I can feel that I'm going into negative or dangerous territory, and I want to tell you about it. And, you know, for us, that is a really positive sign, because that means the process of a circle is successful. The person is starting to self-regulate and taking responsibility and trying to stop themselves from abusing further. And that is a very positive thing. That is really what we aim to achieve.
Yeah, that is so encouraging. And can you tell us a bit about the history of circles? Because it's been operating for more than 30 years now, hasn't it? But it didn't start in the UK.
No, it started in Canada, which is quite an interesting story. There was a quite a high profile person who was kind of in and out of prison all the time. And he was very well known in the public domain. And this person was getting ready for release from prison. And there was, at the time, and bearing in mind this was 30 years ago, there was a huge public outcry against his release from prison because he has committed quite horrendous offences against children. And there was a church community in the Mennonite faith group, and Reverend Harry Nye, who is the most extraordinary person. You know, we were very lucky to bring him out to the UK when we had the 30-year celebration of Circles. And he's truly an amazingly inspirational man. And he then, the prison service liaised with them, and he talked to his church community and said, this man by the name of Charlie Taylor is coming out of prison, and can we maybe support this person through the faith group and through the church community? And, they actually started what they call a process from congregation members who they referred to as Charlie's Angels, and they formed this support group around Charlie, but did exactly the accountability aspect as well. They would go and visit him at his home, make sure he is okay, but also liaise with the statutory agencies about his progress. And what is quite amazing is that in all the years that Charlie Taylor then was supported through that church community, he never reoffended. Mm-hmm. And he actually died in the community whilst being supported by this community a few years later. And that is where Circles came from. They then started doing it with another person. And in the UK, the Quakers got information about this process, and they were quite interested in it. So they went across to Canada, had some conversations, and then came back and discussed with the Home Office and the Ministry of Justice in the UK. And they decided to bring the program, with obviously the permission from the Canadians, to the UK and adapt it for our context. And they ran two pilot programs to test it out, you know, when they developed the initial program. And then the pilots were very successful, and then the Home Office and the Ministry of Justice decided to continue funding for this. And in 2008, Circles UK was established to continue the development, but also to broaden Circles' reach throughout England and Wales and even beyond. Okay. And that's where we came from since 2008. And then since then, we've established Circles quite widely in England and Wales. We also at one point had some Circles in Scotland, and we are talking at the moment to Northern Ireland as well about starting it there. And then what is also part of the wonderful success story is that we then expanded Circles into Europe as well. And they now, through the Circles Europe Association that we set up, Circles UK provided training to the Netherlands, to Belgium, etc. And they're now available in 9 countries in Europe. We chair the Circles Europe board. I myself is the chair of it, and they're actually doing really well in Europe. And then they've also expanded to some parts of the United States, and also Australia at the moment is in the process of commissioning Circles through their government.
Amazing. That's quite a good spread for 30 years. That's really interesting. And I didn't know that there was Quaker involvement in bringing it to the UK, which is quite fascinating for me because I'm just a history nerd, and obviously Quakers have always been part of prison reform and Elizabeth Fry and such like. So
absolutely, and we're very grateful to the Quakers, and we still maintain a very strong relationship with them. When we had our 30-year celebration, they sponsored the venue for us, and we held it in Friends House in London, you know, with a symbolic kind of commemoration of their input in creating Circles in the UK.
Amazing. So from everything that you've learned from your career and working in Circles and the work that Circles has done, what do we know about why people commit sexual abuse?
Well, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? If we could crack that one, we could stop it. I think the first thing to say is that it's never just one factor. Like all of us as human beings, we're the totality of a range of influences. So it's not just one. And there's the usual ones, you know, we operate on an individual level, we operate at a relationship level, we operate in a home context with our families, and then we operate in a peer group with our friends, with our associates, and we also operate on a broader societal level. And all those actually impact people who perpetrate sexual abuse. I mean, just to mention a few, you know, that we find is quite common with the people we work with. There's the kind of psychological and behavioral aspect, you know, things like poor impulse control, cognitive distortions, very, very common. And sometimes just lack of information about sexual responses and, you know, how people operate in a consensual sexual relationship. So sometimes there's those kind of deficits. But also in the home, we find that so many of the people we work with come from adverse childhood experiences where they have witnessed abuse, or some of them have been abused themselves. Now, I just want to clarify that there's a lot of people who have been abused as children who don't become abusers themselves. So very, very important not to just assume if someone has been abused, they will become an abuser. But there is, unfortunately, a bit of a correlation. And then for young people, especially peer group influences, I mean, we see so much now with the concerning developments of online abuse and how many adolescents and teenagers are being, you know, sort of dragged into it. So again, peer influences, sharing of images, all of those kind of things, really, really important. And then on a societal level, I just want to mention a few. Again, if you unequal societies and societies that condone misogynistic elements tend to have very, very high levels of child sexual abuse and abuse in the home and at a wider society level. So it's, as I said, not just one factor, there's just a range of them, you know, and I can tell you a little bit more about the specific aspects of the people that we see coming through the circles, but those are kind of the general factors that interplay into sexual violence and sexual abuse.
Thank you. Yeah. And I think it's so interesting. And having read, you know, your literature around some of the kind of causal factors and things, I think it's really important that you acknowledge and that you show that there's an important element at a structural level and a societal level, as well as an individual level, because often in the criminal justice system, we're really only looking at a very individual level of criminal responsibility, and acknowledging that there is these kind of wider misogynist and sexist kind of elements within our society, which can create a kind of condoning environment, is something that I think that not everybody thinks about, really.
Absolutely. And I think it's particularly relevant, the context that we are in at the moment. You know, so you can't remove the individual from that is really, really crucial.
Mm. And so what have you learnt so far about what prevents sexual offending?
I mean, again, I'll be quite basic in my reply. I think what prevents it is the opposite of what causes it, isn't it? And again, I will particularly mention safe homes, positive homes, where there isn't abuse, where there isn't adverse childhood experience, where children are loved and nurtured and valued. If you want to stop sexual abuse, create safe homes, create safe societies, create equal societies, I think equal homes with all of that. And I think the other one that I will specifically mention, because it is so relevant at the moment, is the whole online space that young people are operating in, and in fact all of us, you know, but specifically damaging for online abuse. There is the aspect of exposure to pornography. Now, what is really interesting, there's a wonderful organization who is based in Finland. They called Protect Children, and they have done research of people who access the dark web for their online abuse. And They have launched their most recent research report, and it's absolutely shocking because that has found from people that have self-reported to them from the dark web that children below the age of 10 are already viewing child sexual abuse and exploitation material. Now, there's a real link between violent pornography, accessing that, and then going into child sexual abuse and exploitation material. I mean, now imagine a 10-year-old being exposed to that. Mm-hmm. And I think the one statistic I've also picked up from them is that 13% had seen child sexual abuse and exploitation material before the age of 10. And 3 in 5 young people have seen it before the age of 18. Now, that is pretty staggering. So there's the issue of, if I as a society had my way at the moment in the UK, we need to look at exposure to pornography. We need to look at exposure to devices. There is the whole debate around what age should a child have a smartphone. I don't have children, but I promise you they would not have smartphones if I had my way. Mm. And also adults, you know, we're all pretty addicted to our phones, isn't it? And what is it really doing to us? And then the other one I'll mention is the regulation of the tech companies. They can put a stop to it today if they want to, but they don't want to. Mm. And they are, having said that, there are also people operating in the tech space who are doing amazingly positive things. And I also just want to hold my hand up to them. But there are others who know exactly what damage their tools and their algorithms are doing, and they are not acting. So really important, the regulatory bodies and protecting children from that. So in order to prevent, I think we're sitting on a time bomb of something enormously serious. And we're going to, in 10, 20, 30 years onwards, we can hold up the phone and say, this is the most dangerous thing we've ever invented, despite the many positive things that are there. We do need to protect young people, which I would really, really stress as a key factor to prevent further abuse. And also, we don't know a lot about how many people start abuse online and then move into, you know, and the language is getting very difficult. We used to talk about contact and non-contact offending, and it's no longer as simple as that, because you can actually have contact offending in a digital space where you have contact with a child or another person. But again, we don't have enough research evidence to see what is that pathway from online into physical contact with a child. But again, the report by Protect Children, in terms of information they got off the dark web, tells them that something like 40% move from online to making contact with a child physically and sexually abusing that child. So again, getting back to preventing online harm, that may also prevent other very serious forms of sexual abuse that are committed in the, and I'm sorry, my language is really inappropriate, but the physical space as opposed to the digital space.
Gosh, I mean, that's horrendously depressing.
To be so depressing, but it's a reality. And, you know, only if we know what the problem really looks like can we find effective solutions. And what makes me really, really sad is we know what some of these solutions are. You know, just stop people from seeing pornography at such a young age. There's things we can do. There's very clear correlations coming out to us, and we're not keeping our young people safe. And what I find very, very sad, we get calls from parents regularly, and they think their children are safe when they get home. They track them outside the home, as in they know when their child gets on the bus when they're coming home from school, because they have location sharing and they have everything on their phones. And then by the time they get home, the parent relaxes, saying, oh, they're home safely. Mm. But then their child goes up to the bedroom and who knows what is happening there. We should have those conversations with our children. And that to me is the biggest tragedy, is that we think our children are safe through these technological interventions that also bring us wonderful, positive things. There's no doubt about it. But we do need to look at the harm that they cause.
But then, of course, also there's so much abuse that goes on in the home for children as well, isn't there? So, yeah.
Absolutely. And, you know, again, when we talk so much about online abuse, we forget about abuse in the home because we've never been comfortable to talk about that. Mm. That's difficult. That is dark. We don't want to know that. And maybe sometimes it's easier to look at the danger in the online space because that moves it away from the home, isn't it? So there's that aspect as well. It's very complicated. And again, that's why I think it's really important to have the balance about the different forms of abuse, that we don't prioritize one over another form. And also that we always remember the victims and the survivors who suffer so enormously and are so traumatized through all these various forms of abuse, whether it's online, whether it's physical, whether it's through having your drink spiked, whether it's whatever. We need to remember their voices and keep on advocating to have a better world for them.
And perhaps you could, because you work with a whole spectrum of people who've offended to different degrees and different ages, are you able to kind of give a bit of an overview of the spectrum of people you work with, who your kind of core members are as well?
Yes. And, you know, again, just to make mention that our programs are delivered by organizations that are affiliated to us, you know, so I'm speaking very much on their behalf today, and they're the ones who are doing the really amazing work. We have our traditional Circles program, which that is the main program that we deliver, and those are for people who come out of prison who have offended. So we intervene after they have committed an offense, and they then stay on a circle for quite a long time. It is between a year and longer. You know, we can extend the circle after sort of on average a 12-month period into longer, up to 18 months and sometimes even a bit longer than that. And that tells you the kind of seriousness of the issues that those core members present with. There's no quick fix for them. You can't put them through 6 or 8 sessions and think they're going to change their behavior. It takes a much longer time.
And sorry, just to clarify, and these are people who've offended against either children or adults?
Yes, it can be both. So we find the majority of offences are against children, but there's also very much abuse against adults as well, and we work with both in that space. And then some of our providers deliver a youth circles program, which was developed a few years ago in partnership with providers and Circles UK. There is a very strong element of people with neurodiverse issues and autistic spectrum conditions. There's also some providers who work in that space and do absolutely wonderful work. What we are seeing is that the people who come through Circles have a higher incidence of neurodiverse conditions or neurodivergence than the general population. And that tallies with the prison statistics. The people who are in prison have a much higher rate of neurodivergence than the normal population. So that's also a strong factor. And then we've also developed a program specifically for online abusers, and we call that Circles Reboot. That's a shorter program. It runs over about 6 months. And because the people who come through there tend to be of a lower risk than our traditional circles, they tend to be often sentenced to community sentences or suspended sentences, and then they come onto our program. It's a bit different from the traditional program because it's semi-structured with some modules and materials that providers can use, but it is still very much individual based. They don't have to use all the materials for a particular core member. Again, what I think is very important to know is that all circles are individual based or core member centered. So no two circles are the same. When you get a core member, you work with the referring agency to work out what are the particular needs of that person. And then the circle is designed around the needs of that person. So the volunteers are chosen to bring a particular aspect to that circle. the coordinator will, who works for the providers, will oversee that. And then also what is discussed in the circle is very much based on the needs of the core member. So there's no fixed module. You're not saying on the 10th of April, you talk about employment, and on the 7th of April, you talk about accommodation or whatever. It is what is relevant for that person in their lives at that moment. And I think that's one of the strengths of circles. And then just lastly, we are in the process of piloting what we call faith circles. And that is circles within the context of faith communities, and whether a circle can actually complement the church safeguarding plans and bring an extra layer of support and accountability. Circles UK doesn't run an official helpline, but very importantly, we get calls from people who are worried about their own sexual behavior and looking for help. People with an attraction to children, for instance, and recognizing that in themselves and saying, I do not want to harm a child. What can I do? We do get calls from people who've been arrested and wanting legal advice or some support mechanism while they go through the process. And then I think what many people don't realize are we're getting a lot of calls from loved ones of perpetrators, as in, my partner has been arrested for child sexual abuse and exploitation material. The family has been blown apart. My neighbors don't talk to us anymore. My partner has lost his job. What do we do? You know, and that kind of knock on the door kind of scenario. And then we also obviously get calls from people whose children and loved ones have been victims of sexual abuse. So we do get that as well. And we tend to signpost wherever we can to other organizations. And what is one of the worst moments for myself and our staff is when you get those calls and there's nowhere where you can refer someone to. Mm. So then we just try and talk to them. And sometimes they call us 2-3 times to just say, I have nowhere to turn. I'm thinking of taking my own life, for instance. And that's quite distressing for staff, especially because we don't run an official helpline. We often refer to the Stop It Now helpline, you know, because they have people on duty who actually run an official helpline, and also the NSPCC's helpline. But that is one of the worst things for us, you know, when you get a call of a person in distress and you know there could be a huge risk to that person. What do you do with so little available?
Is Stop It Now Lucy Faithfull Foundation?
Yes, yeah, the Lucy Faithfull. And we work very closely with them. And, you know, they have highly skilled people to deal with this sort of thing. But it's really tragic, you know, abuse is enormous in all societies. And yet we have so little support for both victims and survivors, as well as for perpetrators and potential perpetrators. And then the secondary victims, who are their families, their children, their loved ones, their parents.
Yes, we're very ill-equipped, aren't we? Perhaps we can talk about a journey, a kind of typical journey of a core member. I know you said that all the circles are completely different and individualized, but maybe you can give us a bit of an example of how one might work practically, like how the circle helps to keep a core member accountable and supported.
You know, when we have, as I explained, providers across the country who are set up to deliver circles, and they would then a referral from the referring agency. In the majority of cases, it's probation, but it can also be police, it can be health, it can be CAMHS.
That's child and adolescent mental health. Yeah.
Yes, sorry, we shouldn't use acronyms. we're so bad with acronyms. But anyway, so they would receive the referral. They would then liaise with the referral agencies about the needs of the person. What kind of risk does this person pose? Is this person safe to be working with volunteers who are very, very well trained, very well equipped for the job, but they aren't necessarily professionals and they need, you know, to be safe in that environment as well. And then the provider will also do their own assessment of the core member to see is the person suitable? Is a circle the right thing for them? Because a circle isn't right for all people. It's a long resource, it's reasonably costly, and it is for people who have the highest needs and pose the highest risk. You know, so it's really important to remember that. But then when the person is accepted on the circle, the provider will then design the circle and find the volunteers who is the best suited for that particular person. They will also brief the volunteers. They will get information on a need-to-know basis so that they can run the circle as effectively as it needs to know. And just so that you know, they don't get all the information of this person. They get what they absolutely need, because we do protect the confidentiality of the person as well. And then the coordinator will prepare the core member for what is going to happen, and then you set up the first meeting. And the first phase of a circle is very much establishing trust, building a relationship. You can imagine it's difficult things to discuss. Some very private, very intimate details could be shared. And no one wants to do that to a group of strangers. So it's really important, that first phase, to establish that, but also to work out what is best for this person in those particular circumstances. And then the circles normally meet weekly at the start of the program, because partly to build the relationship, but also that is when the person needs the most support. And then the whole idea is also, as the circle progresses, is to start, you know, making the support less and less as we go on. So the frequency of meetings, they may be weekly in the beginning, then they may go every 2 weekly, then they may go once a month, etc. So that you also want the person to gain some independence. And in the circle, they would typically look at things like social isolation, because that's the one we find with the majority of our core members. They tend to be socially isolated people. Often they become more socially isolated after they're released from prison because of the stigma that is attached to them. Some of them have said to our providers, I feel there's this, you know, label on my forehead of sex offender, and no one will ever give me a second chance in life, even though I've served my sentence in prison. So social isolation is a big thing. They often lose their family support, their partners, their children, etc. So they also have often very serious communication difficulties and relationship difficulties. So the circle will also focus on that. And then there's a series of a whole range of practical problems, you know, how to have a bank account, how to, you know, when you've been in prison for quite some time, you don't always have those life skills that you need. So they work with them on a range of that. And again, just to say, I've spoken before that there's no structure to traditional circles. The person may turn up on the day and the volunteers may check in with him or her and say, well, what's happening in your life? And the person may say, well, I've had an argument with my mother this morning and she asked me to go and find other accommodation, and I am in crisis. Where am I going to find other accommodation? Then they will look at that with the person. And a few weeks later, it may be something else, as in, I have a debt problem because I can't find a job. You know, how do I deal with that? So it is very much that kind of journey. And what we find after a few weeks, that relationship of trust is really strong between the volunteers. And again, I think that speaks to the amazing qualities of the coordinators who design and set up the circles with such insight and understanding and professional knowledge. And then the volunteers who turn up week after week, they don't get paid for what they do, and they are prepared to give that kind of support and accountability to that person. I think that is pretty extraordinary. And then also the other part of that, throughout that process, there is regular check-ins with the public agency protection arrangements, you know, multi-agency public protection arrangements, the police, etc. So the coordinator provides reports to those. They also report back to the referring agency regularly to share the progress of the person, how that is going. And so there's this constant communication between the statutory agencies that have involvement with the core member and also the referring agency. And all of that happens with the knowledge of the core member. You know, I think even though circles are not mandatory, a person has to willingly agree to come on a circle, there is constant communication to the statutory agencies and that the core member is fully aware of. So it's a completely transparent process.
And is it about 4 or 5 volunteers who are in each circle? Is that right?
Yeah, so the guideline is 3 to 5.
3 to 5.
So it can sometimes stay during the summer periods, and quite a number of volunteers are students. So they may be going home, then the circle may run for a short period, say with 3 volunteers. Then when they come back, it could go back to 4 or 5 or whatever. And sometimes volunteers leave a circle because we all have personal circumstances sometimes, and then the provider will try and replace with another volunteer. But it may be at that particular point in the circle that maybe the person is 2 months from finishing, then it may not be viable to bring in a new person. So that, again, they will look at the circumstances of the person. And again, sometimes with neurodivergent people, it may be better to start a circle with fewer volunteers and then build up a number, because starting a circle with 5 volunteers may just be hopelessly overwhelming for a person with neurodivergence.
Yeah, it's very, very commendable, the work that these volunteers are doing. And I think that you've said in some of your literature as well about how that is kind of creating the community that we need, rather than a kind of ostracizing community, a community which is able to kind of support and hold accountable these people. But are you able to tell us a bit more about these volunteers and what the experience is like for them? Because it is quite a challenging thing, I would have thought, for a volunteer to do and to offer their time to this.
Absolutely. We always say the volunteers are really what makes circles happen, you know. And what many members of the public won't know is, just as we're sitting here, there are more than 700 volunteers out there delivering circles. And very few people know about it, although they do go home, they speak to their communities, to their partners, their mothers, their families, their friends, and they are the best advocates for circles out there. And I think, again, that brings the community link to our work. It doesn't happen in isolation. We did a documentary with Sky News a couple of years ago, and that is available on our website still. And there's an interview, a section of the documentary, where the volunteer talks to a partner, and a partner says, "I'm concerned about you. Are you safe in doing this work?" And she discusses with him, you know, and that is a lovely little clip which gives you sort of insight in how the volunteer's community feels, but also how the volunteer responds to it. And what I find always, I am always inspired when I come in contact with volunteers, because they truly are awesome people. It's a difficult job to do this. It's easier to volunteer in other types of volunteering than what we do in circles. You know, they face dark things, they hear distressing things. They supporting people that most people wouldn't give the time of day. And also, amazingly, some of them are survivors of sexual abuse themselves. And I think that, to me, when I just sit and pause and think of that, I think how extraordinary that someone can reach a point where they can actually turn something that has probably been one of the most traumatic things in their lives into something where they can reach out a hand to someone who does similar things. I think that is hugely powerful. And very often the core members have reported that the fact that the volunteers do this work with them for no payment is what encourages them to change.
Mm.
So I think that is just so inspirational. And also, I have to talk about how the providers train those volunteers, select them, support them continuously. They have to have regular supervision. It's compulsory. It's one of the things that we check in the reviews we do of the providers. And also, volunteers have reported in research projects and surveys and things that have been done over the years that they find the circle enormously valuable. There's a lot of learning for them in the beginning. They hear things that they'd never envisaged, that they'd never imagined. But They actually say it helps them deal with difficult conversations. They learn new skills. They feel also quite privileged that they can support those core members on their journeys, because I think what many say, I thought I would encounter monsters, and actually I didn't. I found ordinary people.
Yeah.
You know, and that is not to condone what they have done. We would never do that. But no one is just a sexual abuser. We all have different identities and different aspects to ourselves. And the circle helps to bring out those other positive traits that often are ignored under the label of sex offending.
Amazing. Yeah. And of course, also prevents there from being further victims as well, because it's an approach which is kind of helping to build up the resilience so that that doesn't happen again.
Absolutely.
And obviously you've kind of said already about the fact that the volunteers are working with people that most wouldn't give the time of day. Certainly the core members and the people that you work with are not, you know, they're not given the most sympathy by society. And so what is the what challenges do you have in general with your work and getting support for your work? Yeah, what's the landscape like? I don't think it can be an easy one to operate in.
No, it's certainly not. I think, and you know, that was one of the, I think when I first started working for Circles UK, that was probably the biggest shock for me is, because I came from the probation service, you know, you work with people who offend all the time and you think, well, you know, everyone knows what that's about. But the two things for me, the biggest challenges of this work is the huge societal stigma against people who commit sexual offences or sexually abuse others. We are prepared to forgive murderers and even terrorists, but we don't forgive, you know, people who sexually abuse. We don't want to give them a second chance as a society. So that, I think, that stigma. And then sometimes organizations who work with perpetrators, we get that stigma too. I was a week ago at an event where someone, when she was introduced to me and found out what I did, said, oh, you do vile work. And I was quite shocked, you know, not often people say things that directly to me. But I just said, no, I don't agree that our work is vile. You may think the abusive acts of people who sexually abuse others are vile, but the work that we do with perpetrators is to prevent further victims. And what is vile about that? You know, so we often get that, and our providers do as well. And then linked to that is we're not first on the list of donations and funding. You know, we have a handful of charitable funders who support our work, and that pool is getting smaller, to be honest with you. We've seen over time a sort of up and down in support for our work. You know, sometimes support is better and then we tend to get more funding. Other times when people feel a bit fatigued by all the reports of abuse, we see that very definitely, you know, when with all this stuff going on with Jeffrey Epstein, I have had discussions with funders who have said to me, we've always supported your work because we think you're a great organization, but we're now thinking maybe we shouldn't be so involved in this space anymore because it's just so incredibly dark. And they feel so overwhelmed by the high numbers and statistics. So some donor and funder fatigue is coming in as well. So the two challenges that has never gone away is the stigma and the need to convince people why we need to do this work. And also to say to them, look, we don't want to take anything away from victims and survivors. Quite the opposite. We want there to be more resources, more support for victims and survivors. But we also can't just lock people away and throw away the key. 99% of people who are in prison for sexual offences are released into the community. Don't we want our communities to be safe? Don't we want no further victims? And that is what it means when you work with perpetrators of sexual abuse. And we just always have to convince people of that, you know. So that can be very exhausting. And it's also, we're always vigilant because you just never know when someone is going to say something like that to you. But we're quite skilled, I think, working in this field and we deal with it because we are passionate about what we do.
I think that's the thing, isn't it? The fact that people are realizing that there is a large scale of sexual abuse going on, but that means we need you and your services more, because you need more support, more funding to be able to prevent it further. So it doesn't make sense to then lock the hatches and stop kind of funding it. It actually needs more resources in order to stop.
And because I've explained, the model is sort of premised on working very closely with the statutory agencies, probation, police, Ministry of Justice, Home Office, etc. So we are also reliant on funding from them. And I can tell you that at the moment we are, Circles UK, as well as our Circles providers out there, are at probably the biggest risk we've ever faced in terms of having government funding cut or even discontinued. And, you know, this is not because individuals don't support our work. We've had massive support from the Ministry of Justice and the Home Office, which I'm always very, very grateful for. But the world is burning, isn't it? And there's so many conflicting funding challenges for the government, you know, having to support people who are going through cost of living things. And then where do they cut? What do they discontinue? But I would like to urge people to continue funding us, because every pound that is cut from our funding will lead to further victims. And we have to do something about it. It's not either or, it's and.
Yeah.
So really important.
What have you been most proud of, or what has most inspired you so far in the work that you've done in Circles UK?
What I'm most proud of is that Circles are effective. And I think they've shown that over the years that we've been in existence. And they show that we can actually work with some of what many people would consider to be some of the most abhorrent people in our society. We work with them and we can achieve change. We can actually ensure that we reduce the number of victims and survivors that are out there in our society. So that is what I'm really proud of, and that we've been doing the long haul. Despite lack of funding, despite opposition to our work, despite sometimes even victim survivor organizations being negative towards our work, despite all of that, Circles UK, together with our network of providers, have stood firm in this, and we have actually defended what we do, I think, really well, and making the argument to our communities how important this is if we're going to prevent further victims and reduce the incredibly high levels of sexual abuse in our society. We need to support and invest in perpetrator programs.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's incredible. I don't think that, I mean, the job that you do feels like a very difficult job to do, and it must require a lot of resilience and a lot of supporting yourself as well, because of the kinds of things that you have to deal with. And so I'm in awe of the work that you've done, and that all of the people in your organization do, and the volunteers. It's really, really brave and important work that we need if we're going to create a better society than the one we've been born into.
Thank you. And, you know, just we have ample evidence that our work is effective, and it does change people's attitudes, behavior, etc. And then, you know, what makes me really happy is when I can go home at the end of the day and I've seen case studies, I've seen quotes from volunteers, quotes from core members. We're working with Mark O'Sullivan at the moment, and he is in the process of recording podcasts with three core members. And he's just been saying it's been such inspirational work, you know, getting an insight into who these people are, and that they aren't necessarily monsters and horrible people. And that is also what I really, really, I feel very happy when we can change people's attitudes in terms of that as well. Then I think that's good enough. And it's back to what I said at the beginning, you can't change the world, but you can change your little corner. And that's what we do every day.
Amazing. You certainly are. Thank you so much. It's been so interesting to listen to you talk and to hear more about circles and to understand more about what it does practically and how it is, you know, working towards preventing sexual abuse. And if people want to support your work, what can they do? Or if they want to find out more about you and circles?
Well, there's significant information on our website. On our website is links to all the providers that deliver circles, so they could click on that and it would take them to the provider website as well, where they all have websites and show how amazing their work is. So I would first of all say go to the website, and then also maybe follow us on social media. We are very active on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, etc. And again, if you look on the website in the top right corner, it will show the social media site. And then also email us through the website. There is an inquiry form. We do respond to every email that we get, so I can give that reassurance. And then if I may be so cheeky, if anyone feels like making a donation or talking to us about longer term funding, we would only be too grateful. And the same for our providers as well. I know that they can do with that as well. We never swimming in money. So anyone feels that our work is worth supporting, please look at our website and make a donation.
Amazing. Thank you. And I can put links to all of your website and the social media links in the show notes so that people can go directly there if they want to find out more information.
Thank you, Maria.
So I just would like to say thank you so much for your time. And I know it isn't easy in terms of kind of the subject matter to do things like podcasts and to go into your work in detail. And I really appreciate the fact that you've trusted me and the podcast to be able to talk about the work that you do, because I think it's really important for more people to understand and to get more of the word out there. So thank you very much for your time and for telling us more about it.
And thank you to you, Marion. You know, your podcasts are so impressive in the way you actually shine a light on so many important organizations and individuals. So thank you for your interest in our work and giving me the space to talk about it. It's much, much appreciated.
Oh, thank you very much. That's very kind of you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Social Justice Salon with me, Marianne Moore. We have so enjoyed deep diving into social justice with you. This podcast is brought to you by the generosity of my Patreon supporters. Patreon subscribers get these podcasts a week early, have access to exclusive content, and can be part of my private community. If you would like to work with me, I provide social justice and business advisory services for a range of needs. To find out more, please visit my website, createtricks.london. If you enjoyed this episode, then please take the time to give it a review or recommend it to a friend to help more listeners find us. We would be delighted for you to share your thoughts, musings, or favourite parts of the podcast with us on social media. You can tag and or follow the podcast at Social Justice Salon and me, Marianne, at createtricks.london on all the major social sites. This podcast was hosted and produced by me, Marianne Moore. I did the artwork, and the music was by the amazing Luke Fraser at The Tonic. Until next time, when I look forward to welcoming you back to the Social Justice Salon.